At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Nah, not those lions. Three lions we can get behind.
And he hoofed it.
There's more pressure being ratcheted up with a loss like that, of course.
Just getting the head boxed off, should that just kind of happen.
For all your Lions coverage this summer, download the OTB Sports app.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetSetGo. Are you ready for quick start car insurance? Get a quote today at GetSetGo.ie.
I'm delighted to say Daniel Harris is with us. Daniel, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm sure you think the idea of a World Cup every 2 years is a spiffing idea.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. I mean, you see it with all different kinds of football and ultimately with all things that people like. Someone realizes they can make a buck out of it, so they just try and do it more and more and more and more often on the basis that people will just lap it up every single time. I mean, they did it with Coronation Street in EastEnders. It used to be on twice a week, then it was three times a week, then it was five times a week. They do it with Marvel films, they do it with music, they do it with everything that they think will make a buck. But obviously what people don't realise is that, or maybe they do realise and think that it will still make them a buck, even though, is that scarcity is what makes things lovable also, that you look forward to things, that what makes them special is the fact that they don't happen very often.
Yeah, it's a relatively simple thing to understand, is that absence makes the heart grow fonder. The fact that World Cups are every 4 years means there's so much time and energy invested in them. The fact that everybody doesn't qualify, like the reason the Italians are such a great story this time is because they're making a comeback from some national shame, and like it's been a very important part of all of the big countries, I think with the exception of Germany, where there has been some catastrophe befalls them, sporting catastrophe, in a qualifying campaign, and it leads to bloodletting, and that's always a really interesting little extra part of the soap opera. If everybody always qualifies, then I don't know. Maybe in 5 years' time, this will happen, and we're like, hey, tournament football, it's what we all love.
Well, that's exactly what happened. Like, we'll be sitting here discussing who we think is going to win it and what we think is going to happen and what the big stories are, because that's what sport and football create, and we enjoy them, and we're mandated to cover the stuff because it's happening. But I mean, we'll see it within the Euros as well. That the Euros, the first Euros I remember, Euro 88, was two teams of four groups, and look at it now. Whereas now we've got 24 teams, and basically that isn't enough because it leads to an unfair system. I think that what we'll see next time is we'll see it go up to eight groups of four, to 32 teams, and that will mean that pretty much everyone qualifies, but taking the shine away from the qualifying tournament, such as it is, and just meaning that basically everyone gets there in the end, will give us a fairer tournament, and it will probably be decided that one is worth sacrificing for the other, but that's the way that it's going, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and like that's where this conversation is coming from Wenger. And it's just an interesting time given the power struggle at the moment between the clubs and UEFA and FIFA. And this would be another way for UEFA and FIFA to further stake out territory and to ring fence. We're going to have access to these players, and there's nothing you can do about it right now because you're at your weakest in terms of political power.
Yeah, and I think we'll also see a Club World Cup coming soon. I remember writing about that probably 15 years ago now, that I thought the Club World Cup, I couldn't believe it hadn't happened yet. And that seemed to me like a good idea. And I think that actually that still is a good idea, except if you think about the amount of money that would generate and where that money is going to end up, it would, unless they redistribute the wealth properly, it won't have a positive effect on national leagues, because the clubs that qualify will just make so much money that they'll then be able to outspend the clubs that they're already outspending by even greater factors. And that will then distort the wages and transfer fees. So as I said, as an idea, the idea of watching that, I'm not sure also the other thing with something like that is, how do you decide who qualifies over a period of time? And do I trust the authorities that will be arranging such a thing to make sure that qualification is something that is earned, or is it just going to be all the richest clubs all the time and then one or two others? But if they work out a good qualifying system and they don't allow the clubs to harvest all the wealth, and those are two tremendous ifs, and we know what will actually happen to them. But if that happened, then I think a Club World Cup would be incredible. But it's the only way of doing it would make the ramifications absolutely dreadful. So it's best left. But I don't think it will be left for much longer.
So you don't count Manchester United's Club World Cup in 2008 as a proper trophy then?
Oh my gosh, I wish I'd have had the money to go to that. No, oh, sorry, you said 2008. I thought for a second you're talking about the one in 1999-2000 where they went to Brazil. And that is, those are some of my most regretted missed games, but I just have run out of money after the treble season. The one in 2008, I mean, it's not a Club World Cup. I mean, you call it, it's nice to be champions of planet Earth. Mm. And I think that United fans always, I mean, the players didn't really care about it. I don't think Fergie cared about it that much either, but I felt like as a supporter, it was always worth winning. I think partly probably, if I'm honest, one of the reasons was because Liverpool never won it in the 70s or the 80s. And it felt like United at that point had been the only British team, only English team, and maybe the only British team as well to be champions of planet Earth. Obviously, that's no longer the case because Liverpool did it subsequently, although they weren't league champions at the time. But it's not the same as playing a couple of games against the champions of Asia and the champions of South America. Is not the same as kind of a four-group tournament of the teams that have been the best over a four-year period, where and it takes 3 weeks and you kind of go and bowl around as though you're watching your country in a World Cup, you're watching your club in a World Cup. So it's not quite the same as that, no. I mean, I was pleased when United were champions of planet Earth in 1999-2000 and in 2008, but in terms of, if you think about how much money whoever earned the rights to that Club World Cup would make, and just how big it would be, because you'd have, let's say you had 16 clubs all in the same place at the same time for an amount of time. I mean, it's colossal. And what we've had until that point isn't that. And I don't think it will be too long before that is a feature of one summer in every four, or even one summer in every two.
Okay, I want to play you this clip. It is Damien Delaney talking about the quality of Southgate and a little bit about just how good this team is at the moment. Have a look.
Is it possible that Gareth Southgate's a genius?
Oh, listen, I think I've had a discussion with you lads. I think he has something, yeah, really. I mean, that Germany game was such a huge risk, colossal risk, to pick seven defenders and just almost kind of hope that they keep Germany at bay and go on and win the game. But look, he seems to have a handle on this team. He seems to have a way of analysing opposition, and he's utilising everything at his disposal, you know, whether it's three at the back, all formations and different types of players. Obviously, if he gets it wrong and, you know, he picks a team against Denmark and he, you know, they're obviously baying for certain players to be in the team, and he kind of withstood that in the group stage. But if he doesn't start certain players and they lose, I don't think he'll be able to set foot in England again. that is the fine line between genius and lunatic.
Yeah, I mean, there's merit in asking the question, where is Southgate at the moment? Like, he gets criticised for not knowing his best team at the start of the tournament and then turns that into a strength by actually being incredibly flexible. The type of flexibility that we would have traditionally associated with, you know, some of the greatest minds in world football. And he can't really get no love for that.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing a really good job. I mean, I said this before, that he said before the Croatia game, he said something that I thought was quite wise, that England could win and it wouldn't mean he'd got the team right, and England could lose and it wouldn't mean he necessarily got the team wrong. And I think that's fair. So the team that Damon was talking about against Germany, I don't think he particularly picked the right team for Germany. He got a result, so it doesn't matter in the end. But England's superiority over Germany, I think, in terms of the players that they have, how settled they are, their youth, their pace, their power, their skill, was a lot more significant than two goals in the last 15 minutes. And when you're watching it on the telly, the commentary are like, this is slow, this is turgid, this is dull, this is a terrible game, neither team's playing well on 70 minutes. And on 90 minutes, you're getting, oh, heroes to a man, what a performance. And then you've got Southgate saying, my team were immense. I don't think that's right. I don't think England played well against Germany. I don't think the team he picked gave them the best route to beating Germany. And had Müller not missed the kind of one-on-one that you never see Thomas Müller miss, England might have drawn or lost that game. But it went for him. And that's important. Things are just going for him at the moment. Against Ukraine, I think he got the team spot on. And I think the team played really well. it was admittedly against Ukraine, and I do think that is important. That where would Ukraine finish if they're in the Premier League? Top half, maybe, probably not. And that's the standard of the team that they absolutely rinsed, but they absolutely rinsed them playing with confidence and verve and enterprise. Now, if England go and play like the same way like that, the same players against Denmark, they'll almost definitely be in the final. And then they'll have a hard game, I mean, against Italy or Spain. I mean, I think as a football supporter, I mean, I ain't supporting them. So as a football supporter, I hope it's Italy, because I think when you watch these tournaments, what you want is you want the best team to win. It is nice every now and again when you get a surprise win like Denmark in 1992. But ultimately, in theory, what is the point of this tournament? Is to tell us who the best team in Europe is. Spain are not the best team in Europe. So I kind of feel like I don't want Spain to somehow finagle the way of winning it. And they are capable of doing that because they're playing quite well. They're just finishing dreadfully. If they'd finished merely sensibly against Switzerland, they'd have won really easily. And if they play like that against Italy and someone happens to have a good day in front of goal, there's a good chance that they'll win. But I would say that I'm certain that England would rather play Spain and Italy, because Italy just look like an absolutely brutal to play against, if nothing else. Like, they'll run all night, they'll press all night, and they're incredibly organised. And I don't think England quite have that level of synchronisation and organisation. They do have better individuals than Italy, though, but I guess they've got to beat Denmark first. And I think that I'd be relatively surprised if Gareth Southgate made too many changes. I mean, I'm sure he'll be thinking about going to three at the back, but it's Denmark, not Germany. And Denmark are riding a wave. They're playing well, but I think that England should feel comfortable that they can go into a game against Denmark and pick what they think is their best team, not pick a team that is also focused on stopping Denmark. Because in midfield, the three players that they have, Mount, Rice and Phillips, it should be enough to have more of the ball than Denmark. And I think that they're more likely to need to stretch the play than they are to clutter up the play. So I think it'll probably be the same team, because I felt like Jadon Sancho wasn't brilliant against Denmark, because that's sort of been the rotating position, the right wing position. But I felt like he played better than Bukayo Saka did in either of the two games that he played. So, and I think that Denmark are more likely to sit back, so England will probably want someone like Sancho who can speed up the play and who will commit defenders. But if you pick Saka, Saka's also a brilliant player, so you'd understand that, just as you'd understand it if you pick Foden.
Yeah.
But I think the rest of the team is pretty much set.
I think he's going to pick Phil Foden. I have a feeling that he was kind of resting him after he got booked to make sure that he was going to be available for this game and then the final. So,
couldn't argue with it if he did. Foden's an amazing player.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. It's not quite knowing what the best England team is at the moment. What is your relationship like with this team then, as not an England supporter per se, but they seem like, from the outside, like about the best of a representation that you could hope for as a national side, as individual men and as a group, a collective team. The things that they've done, the soundings from the camp, As a group goes, this is about the most likeable English football team I've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I said on Twitter the other day that we're talking about it, and I was saying that I'm not an England fan, but I never thought I'd say this, but I'm buzzing for the players, because I like lots of them individually, and as a unit, I absolutely love what they represent. They represent so much of what should be good about England as a country that is not good. They're the antidote to the government. They're the antidote to the culture wars. They are not afraid to speak their mind and stand up for what is important. Like Jordan Henderson, Marcus Rashford have spent lots of time and lots of money giving people food to eat. Jordan Henderson just yesterday was standing up for the rights of the LGBTQ community. You've got Raheem Sterling, Marcus Rashford, Tyrone Mings fighting racism. And they just seem like a great bunch of lads. And there's also that thing when you watch a football team that when they're enjoying it, when they're enjoying each other's company, because ultimately they're doing what we all love to be doing. And when you used to see the old England teams, they felt like they hated it. Like, it was all so important and also on top of them, and also miserable, and also pressurised, and also serious. And this lot aren't like that. Obviously, they want to win and they're taking the football seriously, but they're having the time of their lives. And that sentiment and that sensation is contagious. Like, we all know what it's like to hang out with your mates and go on a holiday with your mates and spend time with them. And we all love doing it. And a lot of us, when we get into that state of life, when we're not, that's not available to us very often, we reminisce about it, or we try and carve out time to get to do it, because they're like, they're formative and important times that we then feel nostalgia and love towards afterwards. And we can see these lads doing exactly that right now. And even though we don't understand what it's like to compete in high-level sport, we understand what a lot of the peripherals are like. And so we identify with them. And they also are standing up for what's right and taking on the government whilst taking on Europe in the meantime. And that is a heady and infectious mix. So, yeah, I absolutely love this team.
Yeah, I can see why. Dinan, let's briefly talk about the Manchester United situation. The Sancho deal obviously has been apparently two and a half years in the making and is finally over the line, at least we think. What difference will he make to the team? How does he improve the team?
Well, he immediately gives you a threat, like in a position you didn't have one. United have basically played without a right winger for years and years now. And I guess since, I can't even remember who the last full-time one was, probably Nani. And that was a long time ago. So what you get is you immediately have a threat on the other side of the pitch. A team can no longer focus, when they're playing United, they can no longer focus their defending on United's left flank and leave Wan-Bissaka on the ball, leave whoever plays on the right on the ball. If it's Daniel James, he doesn't really want to attack down the outside. He wants to play on the left. If it's Mason Greenwood, he wants to attack the box. Well, not anymore. They've now got a proper winger who can go on the outside down the right. And what that also means is you can't be leaving Wan-Bissaka on the ball because he can give it to Sancho. But also, for the last two seasons, Wan-Bissaka has been a one-man right flank. And that's no longer the case. And people have like said that Wan-Bissaka can't attack, can't go forward. But one of the reasons people say that is because he hasn't had any help. Luke Shaw is obviously a better attacker than Wan-Bissaka, but he's also got Marcus Rashford outside him. It makes a massive difference. I think one of the other things is that it means United have struggled with balance for years because they don't really want to play Fred and McTominay. But if you play Bruno Fernandes and Paul Pogba, two high-risk, high-reward players who aren't going to do as much running, then that can leave you unbalanced. But with Sancho, Sancho's not just a winger, he's a playmaker. He's looking to prompt, he's looking to move the ball, he's looking to move across the pitch, he's looking to come deep, he's looking to go through the middle. And that means that you don't need Paul Pogba as much, because you've also got another creator, so that if a team decide they want to double up on Bruno Fernandes, then there's leaving space for Jadon Sancho. And so that gives you an option of, if you were to lose Paul Pogba, what you would lose by losing Paul Pogba is not the same now that you have another playmaker. And I think what it also gives you is, next season, through the middle, it'll be Cavani a lot of the time. But when Cavani moves on the year after that, and you probably have a front three of Rashford, Greenwood, Sancho, you're looking at something a little bit similar to Rooney, Ronaldo, Tevez, in that all three players can play in all three attacking positions and turn up anywhere. They're all quick, they're young, they're adaptable, and that will give you a pretty serious front three as well. And also the way that you're going to play will make it difficult for the opponents because you've no idea who's going to turn up where. So I didn't think that right wing was United's biggest concern, because I felt that Mason Greenwood could give you enough there so that he'd be a good enough workaround, and has been one already. So there are other areas of the pitch that you needed to strengthen. But I'm absolutely sure that teams trying to defend the width of the pitch against United are going to find that they don't have quite enough duvet to cover their feet.
So that front three of Rashford, Greenwood and now Sancho will play in front of a midfield three of Pogba, Bruno and McTominay?
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if Pogba left this summer. And I feel that because they've got Sancho, United are now in a better position to let him go. I think that if they get an offer that they think is all right, I think they'll take that, because they won't want him to go next summer for free. They won't want the whole, is he going, is he not, every 5 minutes, that is probably quite unsettling for the player, for the manager, for the rest of the team. So I think that if Pogba goes, if Pogba wants to go and they get a good offer, I think they'll allow him to go. And then they would replace him with a slightly different player, I think. If you replace Pogba with a player who gave you more running and more and more involvement in the game, then I think that you might end up with a better team. But if you get to keep Paul Pogba, obviously Paul Pogba is an amazing player, so that's also an acceptable state of affairs.
And the other two, the French-related transfers, Raphael Varane, there's definitely noise this is more likely to happen than not, and Eduardo Camavinga is the other one that there's talk about. What do you know about Varane and Camavinga?
Varane, I was told, was good chance of that happening probably about 3 weeks ago now, 4 weeks ago now. I think that'll happen because there doesn't seem to be very much reason for that not to happen. As from Madrid's perspective, they can't afford to lose him for free and he wants to leave. So they'll take whatever money they can get. There doesn't seem to be anyone else competing. And United, I was told, is where he wants to go. So then it just becomes a matter of his personal terms. Seems unlikely in the end that they're not going to be able to find a sum enormous enough that he will take, but in that small enough that United are happy to pay it. And the transfer fee is, when the transfer fee seems so low, what are they going to end up haggling over? Whether it's 50 million euros or 60 million euros for... And the thing with Varane is, however good or bad he would be if he turned up, he's going to be better than Victor Lindelof. And so you know that he's going to be better than what you've got already. So I think there's a good chance that transfer happens. I mean, I was told a few days ago that it wasn't that far along yet, but I do think that one will happen. Camavinga, I don't know anything about. But again, it sort of fits United's bill because he's a player who's available for free next summer, which means the selling club probably feel that they've got to sell. And there doesn't seem to be anyone else who's immediately interested. And he's a young player of the sort that United like to buy, who they probably feel is a blue chip talent. You can't fail with that guy because they know that he's great. And there's a lot of people who seem to have suddenly acquired season tickets to Rennes over the last couple of weeks. I'm not one of them. I've seen Camavinga play once, I think, and I think he's a good player. But people that have seen him play more often think that he could be a world-beating player. So again, there doesn't seem to be that much reason for that deal not to happen, but I don't have any information about it, so I have no idea whether or not it will happen. I just read actually this morning that Julien Laurent was saying that they're looking at including Donny van der Beek in the transfer on loan for Varane, incidentally, which would be another deal that probably another way of helping that deal work out well for both parties. But back to Camavinga, if van der Beek went as well, that sort of leaves you some space for Camavinga. And with Camavinga, what you get is you get someone who could be the number six that you might want. But it seems like most people think that if you limit Camavinga's running, then you sort of limit him as well, even though he could be good enough to play that role. So if you were to sell Pogba, then you might replace him with Camavinga for roughly the same money that you sold Pogba for. And then with the money that you save on wages, then or with your transfer budget, then you could also buy number six. I'm not sure. But both those signings seem extremely feasible. But Varane, I would say, yeah, I have been told that Varane wants to come to United and it just seems that the money's not going to be prohibitive. So, yeah, I think Varane will happen. Camavinga, you have to listen to other people that say they know what's going on because I'm not one of those. But, right. Yeah, it seems likely.
Daniel, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
All right, see you again, lads. Goodbye, everyone. Have a good day.
You too. Daniel Harris giving us some thoughts there on the England scenario and, of course, the latest situation with Manchester United. We'll have to bring back a deal or no deal fairly soon, given the amount of transfers that it seems are imminent and that will be wrapped up immediately after the Euros. There's going to be a slew of deals done as teams go out and agents get stuff done before the short break and then pre-season starts and then there'll be another slew of deals just before the transfer window closes. So we should be entering a busy period for that.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetsetGo. Are you ready for quick start car insurance? Get a quote today at GetsetGo.ie.